This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Valley of Genius, the uncensored history of Silicon Valley, as told by the hackers, founders, and freaks who made it boom. Written by Adam Fisher. Read by Pete Larkin. For Curie, forever and always. Stay hungry, stay foolish. Steve Jobs, quoting Stuart Brand. Please enjoy the PDF that accompanies this audiobook.
Preface. I grew up in what is now known as Silicon Valley. Only in retrospect does it seem like an unusual place. As a kid, it seemed mostly suburban and safe and even dull. Except for the fact that there were also a lot of nerdy hacker types around, and they kept things interesting in their own way. The woman who lived next door to us ran the computer center at the local community college. In the late 70s, my mom would drop me off there so I could play Colossal Cave Adventure, a text-only choose-your-own-adventure type game.
You are standing at the end of a road before a small brick building. Around you is a forest. A small stream flows out of the building and down the gully. What's next?
I never even touched the actual computer, as it was a mainframe and kept safely behind glass. I played Adventure by poking away at a so-called dumb terminal, a keyboard and teletype machine at one end of a long cord. Adventure was primitive, but fun, and still the best babysitter I've ever had.
Kill Dragon,
I typed.
With what? Your bare hands?
Rattled the printer.
Yes,
I pecked.
Congratulations. You have just vanquished a dragon with your bare hands. Unbelievable, isn't it?
A few years later, in 1979, the family next to our next door neighbors bought their own computer, an Apple II. It was astonishing. You could touch it, take it apart, modify it. It used an ordinary color TV as a screen. I vividly remember helping to insert a chip into the motherboard that enabled lowercase. On the Apple II, the adventure was conducted in both upper and lower case. Wow! But it wasn't just text-based adventure games. The Apple II could also play video games. Little Breakout was the classic, a copy of Atari's Breakout arcade game, and in one crucial dimension, even better than the original. Little Breakout was written in BASIC, and thus the source code could be examined and even vaguely understood. Take line 130, for example. 130.
Print, congratulations, you win.
That line could be rewritten to take advantage of the lowercase chip, like so. 130.
Print,
congratulations, you win.
Or even,
print,
congratulations, Adam, you have just vanquished Little Breakout with your bare hands.
I learned that with a little hacking, one could make the computer say and do anything. And I was hooked. That's my story. The audiobook you're about to listen to is a compendium of the most told, retold, and talked about stories in the Valley. They're all true, of course. But structurally speaking, most of the stories have the logic of myth. The oldest of them have acquired the sheen of legend. Doug Engelbart's 1968 demonstration of his new computer system is known as the mother of all demos. Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak have become archetypes, the genius entrepreneur and the genius engineer. Collectively, these tales serve as the Valley's distinctive folklore. They are the stories that Silicon Valley tells itself. To capture them, I went back to the source. I tracked down and interviewed the real people who were there at these magic moments. the heroes and heroines, the players on the stage, and the witnesses who saw the stories unfold. Almost everyone is still alive. Many are, in fact, still young. And I had them tell me their stories. What happened? What did you see? What did you feel? What does it all mean? I interviewed over 200 people, most of them for many hours. Along the way, I learned a lot of things. The first surprise was the range of types of people that I encountered. Silicon Valley grew from a few suburban towns to encompass the cities around it, and that growth was fueled by a rather remarkable diversity. There is no Silicon Valley ethnic type, per se. Silicon Valley is racially diverse. It is the proverbial melting pot, though it's also true that black people are still far and few between. Women are also underrepresented, although there are many more than one might imagine. And there's no typical age either. Silicon Valley focuses on its young. That's where the new ideas usually come from. But it's also been around for a long time. However, there were some commonalities. Almost to a person, their childhood sounded like mine. There was an early exposure and then fascination with computers, usually because of computer games, which ultimately led to a fascination with hacking, computer science, or even electrical engineering. The names of the games change, but the pattern remains the same. After the interviewing came the transcribing. I had hundreds of hours of transcripts, millions of words of memories. The printouts filled an entire bookcase in my office. Then came the real work. I cut the transcripts together as one might so many reels of film. The editing process was often literally done with printouts, a pair of scissors, and a roll of tape. I'm a big fan of computers. I can't write without one. But the old-fashioned way of editing still works best, I've found. Artificial intelligence is nowhere near good enough to transcribe an interview with any accuracy either. And of course, there is no automating the process of reporting, tracking people down and convincing them to talk to me. Shoe leather, sharp scissors, and scotch tape made this book possible, an irony that didn't always seem funny to me. The process took 4 solid years of full-time work and constant focus. By another measure, it has taken even longer. I have been gathering string, banking interviews, for the past decade. It would have been much easier to simply write a history of Silicon Valley instead of to painstakingly construct one, but I felt that would have missed the point. These aren't my stories. They're the collective property of the Valley itself. I wanted to disappear because I want you, the listeners, to hear the stories as I had heard them, unfiltered and uncensored, straight from the horse's mouth. The stories are told collaboratively as a chorus, in the words of the people who are actually there. There's not much of me in this book, but of course all journalists have their biases, their point of view. Here's mine. I think that what's most interesting, most important about Silicon Valley is the culture, that aspect of the valley that gets under people's skin and starts making them think and act different. I was indoctrinated at a computer camp. At the time, 1982, there was only one. There, I met a counselor who signed his postcards home with a squiggle. The squiggle is the symbol for a resistor, the electrical kind that one might see on a circuit diagram. Silicon Valley is a sheltered place, but the intense vibrations emanating from Berkeley and San Francisco did penetrate. I found Mr. Resistor fascinating. He was working on a secret project for something that he called a, quote, startup company, and it was going to, quote, change the world. The next summer, Mr. Resistor hitchhiked to my house and gave me and my father the full vision. One day, he predicted, everyone will have a mobile phone in their car. He even had a color brochure that showed a man happily chatting away on a phone while sitting in his Honda Accord. Because, he explained, soon car phones won't just be for rich people. Then he said his goodbyes and left via the public bus system. I was skeptical. Would the future be invented by a hippie who doesn't even own a car? My father was less so. Maybe, he mused. I left Silicon Valley for college and then returned a dozen years later as an editor for Wired magazine. There I started to notice something odd, that the stories about Silicon Valley emanating from the New York media world were vastly different than those stories that I had heard at sleepaway camp and in computer rooms, and then later in barrooms and at Burning Man. There was a cognitive dissonance there. New York just doesn't get it, I told myself. Eventually, I came to understand that it all came down to perspective. The mainstream media sees Silicon Valley as a business beat, a money story. Who's up and who's down in the new economy? Who's the latest billionaire? Those are valid questions, maybe even interesting ones, but not to me. In the Silicon Valley where I'm from, the stories were almost never about money. They were tales of resistance, heroism, and struggle. Yarns about the creation of something out of nothing, and the derring do required to pull such a feat off. In short, they were about dragon slaying. That's still true, at least in the Silicon Valley I know. Those were the stories that got me excited, and they still do. I'm not saying there isn't an economic story to be told. In fact, I think that we are witnessing the greatest transition since the Industrial Revolution. A new economy, the information economy, is being created, and the center of that new economic order will be Silicon Valley. And if that's not the business story of the century, what is? Still, the bigger question, in my humble opinion, is how that transformation will transform us. We begin to see the answer in the culture that's being created in Silicon Valley now. It's future-obsessed and forward-thinking. It's technical and quantitative. It's market-oriented. It's simultaneously practical and utopian. It's brainy, even in its humor. In short, it's a nerd culture. And of course, there have been nerds since time immemorial. Leonardo da Vinci was a nerd. Ben Franklin was a nerd. Einstein was the quintessential nerd. But the new thing is that the nerd culture is becoming the popular culture. Evidence for that idea, once grokked, is everywhere. Exhibit A, The Big Bang Theory, a show by, for, and about nerds, is one of the highest-rated and longest-running television sitcoms ever. Exhibit B, The Martian's Unlikely Journey from Self-Published NASA Fan Fiction to Blockbuster Hit. Exhibit C, the fact that XKCD, a web-based comic devoted to romance, sarcasm, math, and language, has any audience at all. Even more astonishing, at least to me, is that this new popular culture is a youth culture. The kids who are searching for an exciting life no longer want to be rock stars or rap stars, but rather Silicon Valley-style tech stars. They want to be Steve Jobs, or Mark Zuckerberg, or Elon Musk. As listeners will discover, technology entrepreneurs have never made particularly good role models. Atari founder Nolan Bushnell essentially invented the role of the 20-something-year-old Silicon Valley CEO almost a half century ago. And he may have been the baddest bad boy that the Valley has ever seen. His protege, Steve Jobs, was not much better. At the same time, this new nerd culture is the best possible news for our collective future, given the awesome challenges ahead. Soon there will be 9 billion people crowding this warming planet, and each one will come equipped with a supercomputer in their pocket. So I'm optimistic, bullish even. Who better to inherit the Earth at a time of crisis than a generation obsessed with science and engineering? It's pretty clear where this new nerd culture came from. It came from the same place that the money did, Silicon Valley. And what is a culture? There's no mystery there either. A culture is simply the stories that define a people, a place. It's the stories we tell each other to make sense of ourselves, where we came from, and where we are going. And here those stories are in this audiobook. Together, they comprise an oral history of Silicon Valley. Signed, me, Adam Fisher, Alameda, California, June 2018.
Silicon Valley Explained. The story of the past as told by the people of the future. Silicon Valley is a seemingly ordinary place. A suburban idyll surrounded by a few relatively small cities. So how is it that the valley keeps conjuring up the future? Well, take it from this historian. The difference lies in how the people here tell their story. They see their own history in a way that's subtly different from the way history is generally taught. It's not the historical materialism of Karl Marx, the story of exploiters and the exploited, nor is it the romanticized history of bards and poets, one tragedy after another. History, to Silicon Valley, is the story of the new versus the old. How one technology is vanquished or subsumed by the next. Traditionally, history itself starts with the written word, the technology, the first medium. But in the valley, we fast forward to the invention of the computer, the meta-medium that absorbs all media before it. Hard on the heels of the computer comes the invention of the Internet, the network of computer networks. Next up is the always-on, always-connected smartphone, the Internet in your pocket, and so on. In this telling, history is not something that happens to people. It's made by people. And in our era, it's made in Silicon Valley. Steve Jobs. I do think that when people look back in 100 years, they're going to see this as a remarkable time in history, and especially this area, believe it or not. Steve Wozniak. Creativity is high here. It's okay to have dreams and think about them and think maybe you could make them, here more than other places. Ron Johnson. There's the bay on the east and the foothills on the west, and they're about 5 miles apart, and the entire valley kind of runs from Stanford to the south toward Cupertino, and to the north toward San Francisco. Jameis McNiven. The first gold rush. That's what launched San Francisco. It was a sleepy little town of 1,200, and then 3 years later, there's 300,000 people in the Bay Area. Scott Hassan. Back in the 1870s, California, for some reason, decided to enact a law that prohibits employers from suing former employees for going on to a competing company. Brad Handler. The reason goes back to the Spanish control of California through Mexico. The law, in Spain, through Mexico, to the California territory, did not allow what we now call covenants not to compete. Most other states will enforce a covenant not to compete. But in California, covenants not to compete are non-enforceable. Period. Scott Hassan. That's a big deal. A lot less innovation happens on the East Coast, because they believe in these non-competes. Jameis McNiven. We had railroads, real estate, aviation, we had oil. Hollywood was a giant rush. Oranges. So we're used to that gold rush mentality, and we've had a lot of rushes. Rabble. It's easy to see the web companies or this generation of companies and think that the stuff going on in Silicon Valley is new. But it's not. The reason there is stuff going on here with technology is because this is where radios were designed during World War I. Dan Kottke. Lee DeForest, he invented the vacuum tube. It was called the Audion, and it was the first amplification device. It was a huge step forward. His company was called the Federal Telegraph Company,
and there is a bronze plaque in downtown Palo Alto where his lab was. Lee DeForest, he's right up there with Edison in my mind. Jameis McNiven. The vacuum tube allowed for amplification of sound, which led to the music industry and also to Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler was big on the radio, but they also discovered that the vacuum tube could be used as a switch, on, off, on, off. Steve Jobs. Before World War II, two Stanford graduates named Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard created a very innovative electronics company, Hewlett-Packard. Jim Clark. You can name probably 30, 40 companies that started out at Stanford now. Big ones. Ron Johnson. Stanford really is the epicenter of the Valley, and most of the companies, the people of these companies, had a connection to Stanford. Jameis McNiven. Stanford was the first major university that reached out in a big way into the business community and said, "Hey, we have this open door policy. Come on in. Do business. Go out and do business." Jim Clark. Contrast that with the Ivy League. They had their nose in the cloud. "We are beyond business. Business is dirty." We are not talking about applications. We are talking about advancing knowledge and research. Steve Jobs. Then the transistor was invented in 1948 by Bell Telephone Laboratories. Jameis McNiven. And that allowed us to turn switches on and off even faster, 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 faster. In the binary world, on-off is very important. Steve Wozniak. William Shockley invented the transistor, and that was going to be the growing industry. Andy Hertzfeld. In some ways, Silicon Valley itself was an accident of William Shockley being born here. Steve Jobs. Shockley decided to return to his hometown of Palo Alto to start a little company called Shockley Labs or something. He brought with him about a dozen of the brightest physicists and chemists of his day. Poe Bronson. At Shockley Semiconductor, some people who felt mistreated, who felt mismanaged, left. They went over to a new funder, Fairchild, who said, "Yes, we'll take you guys over here." Steve Jobs. Fairchild was the second seminal company in the Valley after Hewlett-Packard, and really was the launching pad for every semiconductor company in the whole semiconductor industry, which built the Valley. Poe Bronson. Then Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore left Fairchild to start Intel. And that just didn't happen anywhere else in the country. Labor laws were different in other states. Brad Handler. It's just a public policy difference from hundreds of years ago. Jameis McNiven. Then Moore created this law he's famous for. Computer power doubling every 18 months. Alvy Ray Smith. Moore's law went into play in 1965. And from then on, the more powerful computer you have, the smaller they got. Gordon Moore. By making things smaller, everything gets better at the same time. The transistors get faster, the reliability goes up, the cost goes down. It's a unique violation of Murphy's Law. Jameis McNiven. And Moore keeps saying, "Well, that's about to end." And then it doesn't end. Steve Wozniak. Transistors were subject to Moore's law and boomed into chips and bigger chips that could do more and more over time. Silicon Valley is called Silicon Valley because of the material silicon that makes hardware chips. The area was growing economically. Alvy Ray Smith. And then the venture capital idea came along. And as far as I can tell, that idea had never been tried before. There were bankers who could loan you money, but they wanted guarantees that could get it back. Venture capitalists expect failure. They discovered that they could gamble big with maybe 10 firms. Mark Porat. Just throw a lot of things into the funnel, attract a lot of smart people, and make them interact in unmanaged ways. Go chaotic on the whole system of innovation. Just let it happen. Call the good stuff from the bad stuff. Find a relatively efficient, not perfect, but relatively efficient solution. The thing blows up? Nobody cares. If it goes big, then they want to stuff as much money into it as possible. Alvy Ray Smith. And if one of them hit, it would pay for all of the failures. That was a new idea. Steve Jobs. People started breaking off and forming competitive companies, like those flowers or weeds that scatter seeds in hundreds of directions when you blow on them. Poe Bronson. That is pretty legitimately the true origin of the culture here. The I need to leave my big thing to start something small story. Ezra Callahan. It's a place where people with an idea and some talent can make something huge out of something small. It's the success stories of young entrepreneurs with no particular business experience who, within a matter of months, become industry-creating technological celebrities. Poe Bronson. That became an imprint that got repeated and repeated and repeated. Steve Jobs. And that's why the Valley is here today.
Carol Bartz. The future doesn't just happen.
Ev Williams. Sparks happen, and then it just erupts. I think a lot of it has to do with networks. Networks, they get bigger. Ray Sidney. There's this network effect. Sharp people come to be with other sharp people. People come to Silicon Valley just to be with these movers and shakers, and brilliant engineers and product designers and marketers and sales folks and whoever. Lee Felsenstein. The story of Silicon Valley is the story of networks. There was never any centralized place. They were all what they call local maxima. Little mounds of people here and there, and people move between them. And that's the important thing. So it's a decentralized set of networks with mobility among them.
Marissa Mayer. I've heard both the founding stories of Google and Yahoo, and for both those companies, the founders didn't even have to get into a car. They could literally go to the law office, the venture capitalists, the bank, on a bike. It's all that close together.
Or quit Bayou Coctin. The network in Silicon Valley helps you to connect with people who can create that magic, right? So if you have a great idea, you can meet up with a good designer or engineer, and then maybe with an angel who would support it. And then you can make it happen. Jerry Kaplan. And for every one of them, there are 1,000 people who came here with a good idea and burned through their savings without being successful. Mark Porat. People fail in one, but they learn enough so that they succeed in another. And success breeds success. Orkut Bayukoktun. I think all over the world people have great ideas, but they don't necessarily have the means to implement them. In Silicon Valley, it's a lot easier to make an abstract idea and turn it into reality.
Carol Bartz. There are more people attracted to the concepts, and there are more tools. Computing has gotten stronger, faster. Data collection? Stronger, faster. Video? Stronger, faster. And so we have the basics now to make increasingly fast changes.
Andy Hertzfeld. Once you have a pipeline going, the pipeline wants to be filled. Biz Stone. The infrastructure is here. The real estate people, the legal people, the you name it people, they get startups. So it's easier. Well, okay, you're a startup, so here you go. It's just easier to do startup stuff because everyone in the whole ecosystem knows about startups. Guy Barnahum. Silicon Valley is not one thing. You have layers. You have the engineers and you have the bankers. But the people who are active ingredients, the troublemakers, the Tony Fidels, the Steve Jobses, they're really lusting for fame. They want to be relevant. They want to be recognized. They want to be famous. And when they get that, it all ties to money, of course. Big money. Jeff Skoll. We're living in an age of ever-growing celebrity status for entrepreneurs. Jerry Kaplan. That's what makes it tick. Without that, nobody comes, nobody invests, and it doesn't work. Rabble. One of the things that I find fascinating is that people from the outside perceive it as super competitive. They see it as a kind of uber capitalism. But when you look at people who work in it, The identity and the communication, the vibration, is more with communities, networks of people, than the companies. You really often see teams of people who will go from one company to the next company. Aaron Siddig. The best way to think about Silicon Valley is as one large company, and what we think of as companies are actually just divisions. Sometimes divisions get shut down, but everyone who is capable gets put elsewhere in the company, maybe at a new startup, maybe at an existing division that's successful, like Google. But everyone always just circulates, so you don't worry so much about failure. No one takes it personally. You just move on to something else. So that's the best way to think about the Valley. It's really engineered to absorb failure really naturally. Make sure everyone is taken care of and go on to something productive next. And there's no stigma around it. Scott Hassan. It's like a huge, huge, huge company where there's no one running it. And you can do whatever the fuck you want. And the only thing that matters is whether the market cares about what you produce or not. That's the only thing that matters. And you will go away if you're not producing something of value, period. And nobody decides it for you other than this nameless market. Fortunately, as the internet grows, the market gets even bigger and bigger and bigger. Alex Tutick. We've had a lot of help from Moore's Law. Chuck Thacker. Moore's Law is like compound interest. It gave us exponential growth. Alex Tutick. But that doesn't explain it. The rest of the world gets the same help from Moore's Law. John Battelle. At its core, Silicon Valley is a culture. Dan Kotke. Silicon Valley was a nerd-driven culture, and the engineers were the priesthood. John Battelle. It was a culture of hardware hackers and software writers who were generally older, mid-30s to 50. Generally bearded, generally grimy, super fucking smart. What we would call on the spectrum now, but back then there wasn't a term for it. Generally, that was the heart of the Valley culture. Jim Warren. For the most part, folks were doing it as a labor of love, and it was about the excitement of pushing the frontier. Tiffany Schlein. There was something incredibly exciting about being at the frontier of this new medium, and this new culture that we were creating. Steve Jobs. In the 70s and the 80s, the best people in computers would have normally been poets and writers and musicians. Almost all of them were musicians. A lot of them were poets on the side. And they went into computers because it was so compelling, because it was fresh and new. It was a new medium of expression. Poe Bronson. You have a culture riding on top of a technology that's accelerating super fast, and so that culture gets replicated just as much as the technology does, and you put those two together and you get something distinctly unique. Steve Jobs. This is the only place in America where rock and roll really happened, right? Most of the bands in this country outside Bob Dylan in the 60s came out of here. From Joan Baez to Jefferson Airplane to the Grateful Dead. Everything came out of here. Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, everybody. Why is that? That's a little strange when you think about it. You also had Stanford and Berkeley, two awesome universities, drawing smart people from all over the world and depositing them in this clean, sunny, nice place where there's a whole bunch of other smart people and pretty good food. And at times a lot of drugs and a lot of fun things to do, so they stayed. Fred Davis. As Detroit was to the car, the Bay Area was to LSD. This is where it was all coming from. It was definitely part of the culture. Acid was a university lab product since the 50s. Are you serious? Then the Youth International Party, or Yippies, a group combining psychedelic culture with the revolutionary New Left, sprang up and became very powerful in 1968. And the phone freaks were into the Yippies. And the Yippies were into the phone freaks. And Captain Crunch somehow figured out that he could make a free long-distance phone call anywhere. Captain Crunch. You blow a whistle, and if it's just exactly 2600 hertz, that's the tone that operators use. With that, you have the same power that an operator has. Steve Jobs. It was miraculous. Blue boxing, it was called. Are you serious? It was an idea that Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak and Lee Felsenstein at the Homebrew Computer Club loved. That's the connection between the hacker culture and the counterculture, going all the way back to the 70s. That's not really widely known. Brad Templeton. As a personal computing nerd, I think of Nolan Bushnell as the first round. Yes, there was much stuff before. There was Fairchild. Steve Wozniak. Engelbart. When you get to computers, Engelbart is great. Brad Templeton. But I count Atari, actually, as the beginning. Don Valentine. Steve Jobs was the son of Nolan Bushnell. Not literally, but he evolved the same way, and Apple was in many ways an evolution of Atari. A lot of Steve's original thinking came from Nolan. Steve Wozniak. Atari, yes, they started an industry of arcade games, but what was the first arcade game ever that was software? And what was the first time it was color? The Apple II. That was a huge, huge step. Larry Brilliant. Steve used to write me when he started Apple. I would get these letters, and then one day he just called me. He said, do you remember when we would say, power to the people? That's what I'm doing. I'm giving power to the people. I'm building a computer that every person can put on their desktop, and I'm going to get rid of the high price of the mainframes. Bruce Horn. There was so much discussion, and so much talk, and so many brilliant ideas, and everyone just came together.
Christina Woolsey. But we've also got our hippies, our beatniks, our gays. I'm an old-timer around here, and that's just in my lifetime.
Ray McClure. The sharing of ideas and merging of alternative cultures, alternative lifestyles, people's ability to express themselves, whoever they are.
I think that that's the real heart of the creativity.
That's what has made it a fertile place for new ideas. John Battelle. It was the people who kind of first gathered around the Atari and the Apple II and later around the Mac. And then later around the CD-ROM revolution and the multimedia revolution of the late 80s and early 90s. And they were the same people. James McNiven. We had the Whole Earth Catalog as Bible. Then it went electronic, the well, and it became one of the backbone models for the Internet. These guys around here invented the new world. John Battelle. They also gathered around science fiction, right? Steve Wozniak. Science fiction leads to real products, but first you've got to deal with the laws of physics and ask, what's it going to cost? John Gianandrea. I'm fond of this book by Arthur C. Clarke, Profiles of the Future. He splits the book into two sections. One section is things that will happen, like self-driving cars. The other is things that will be surprising if it happens, like time travel. And the thing is, the kind of people who worked at General Magic or Netscape would be like, show me the technical detail that makes this possible and sign me up. John Battelle. They were these really smart engineering types who had non-standard political views. They leaned more libertarian, sometimes anarchist. They were far more left than right, but at its core it was a culture of people who believed that something really fucking big was going on. That it was bigger than them, that it was bigger than the products that they were working on, that there were the seeds of a true movement happening.
Christina Woolsey. It wasn't about being able to talk on a less expensive phone line or being able to do video chats or having a cell phone with the power of a computer. The bigger question was always, how is the digital revolution going to change society and people?
Jamie Zawinski. We weren't building a toy. We were building a communications medium. We were letting people connect to each other in a way that they hadn't been able to before. It was the opposite of television. It was giving people a voice. John Battelle. But it was not until the Web 1.0 boom that there was a sense that this was only a Silicon Valley thing. It was just that This is where most of the companies were. Jordan Ritter. The defining moment was the rise of Google. If there was ever a paragon of the engineer thumbing their nose at conventional management, conventional software development, conventional everything, it was them. That's the point where it shifted, when the engineers were treated as valuable as they really are. Ev Williams. One of the interesting shifts that has happened is the move to San Francisco. Silicon Valley, until the dot-com boom, wasn't in San Francisco. It was in Palo Alto and Mountain View, because tech companies weren't built in the city. Steve Wozniak. The hardware industry has sort of settled down, and all the new things that catch our attention, the apps and Ubers, they've kind of chosen to move up to San Francisco. Silicon Valley includes San Francisco now. Biz Stone. San Francisco is the cool place to be. Ev Williams. My theory is that as these tech companies have become more culture makers, then they gravitate toward the city, because that is who makes culture, people who live in cities. And now it's maturing to a degree where you can be in tech and be a pure business person, and there's lots of them, and lots of lawyers, and now there's lots of artists, and those people are part of tech too. And they live in cities, and they live in San Francisco. Louis Rossetto. The 90s marks this transition where all the original technical breakthroughs started to bite in society at large. There is a switch happening. The blog gave way to the tweet and to Facebook. Jim Levy. To me, by the 90s, it wasn't fun anymore, though I'm sure a lot of people had a lot of fun. I'm sure Mark Zuckerberg had a lot of fun putting his thing together. I know the Google guys had a lot of fun. They are still having a lot of fun. Steve Wozniak. The iPhone is the coup de grace. When you use your iPhone, you still have a personal computer. But your PC is in a data center. It's taking data off hard disks, analyzing it, and determining what to show. And it sends it to your iPhone to show you. So you really have a PC, but you don't see it. It's not yours, so it's not personal. You have a computer, but it's not personal. Sean Parker. And then it becomes the post-social media era. It's all the people who would have become investment bankers who want to go start internet companies, and it's a purely commercial, purely transactional world. It's just become this transactional thing. And it's attracted the wrong type of people. It's become a very toxic environment. A lot of people have shown up believing, maybe correctly, that they can cash in. But that's Silicon Valley, the ATM machine. Not Silicon Valley, the font of creativity and realization of your dreams. Biz Stone. Only in Silicon Valley can you be like, yeah, we would like $10 million and we'll sell you a percentage of our theoretical company that may one day have lots of profits, and if we lose all the money, we don't have to give it back to you. And maybe we'll start something else. In what crazy world does something like that exist? Like, wait, you can just blow the money, and then you don't owe it back. Just wash your hands clean. Done? Sorry about that. Sorry I spent all your money. Oh, well. I mean, it's just crazy. And not only that, here's another scenario. Here's what some people do. They say, we need $25 million, but you know, just so we can stay focused, my co-founder and I each need $3 million of that money in our bank accounts. Then we don't have to worry about bills, so we can really focus, okay? And then when they blow the money and they say, oh well, that didn't work out, but we're still keeping the $3 million each, so now we're rich. What the hell? That is crazy. So it's a crazy world. This is like some kind of nutty place where you can do that kind of stuff. Steve Perlman. We today in Silicon Valley are at a similar level of maturity as the automobile industry in 1950. What happened in Detroit was that the winners ended up getting consolidated to the big three, and there was no other player that could enter that industry that could possibly compete. The people that succeed in these large companies are the ones that make the safe bets. The people that don't rock the boat. The people that get along with everyone. The people that don't do things which show up the other lifers there and disrupt their opportunities to advance in the organization. Those are the people that gravitate to and stay at the larger companies. Steve Wozniak, that turns me off a lot. Now your importance is measured by what company you're in and what you do. I don't like that. Steve Perlman, is there any way that Silicon Valley can recover what it's lost? Andy Hertzfeld, the most important thing really is the motivation. Why are you doing what you're doing? That seeps into the product at every level, even though you think it might not. Your basic values are essentially the architecture of the project. Why does it exist? And in Silicon Valley, there are two really common sets of values. There are what I call financial values, where the main thing is to make a bunch of money. That's not a really good spiritual reason to be working on a project, although it's completely valid. Then there are technical values that dominate lots of places where people care about using the best technique, doing things right. Sometimes that translates to ability or to performance, but it's really a technical way of looking at things. But then there is a third set of values that are much less common, and they are the values essentially of the art world or the artist. And artistic values are when you want to create something new under the sun. If you want to contribute to art, your technique isn't what matters. What matters is originality. It's an emotional value. Chris Kane. This is a little cliched and eye-rolling, and it's not true for all the entrepreneurs, but I think for a large portion of the entrepreneurs here, they generally kind of make the world better. Look at all these entrepreneurs who are living five to an apartment, who are not making a lot of money and may never make a lot of money. They can get a six- or seven-figure job at a bank or a large company, but they choose to do this. At the end of the day, it's not money. It's this emotional connection. I am somehow connected with this world in a different way, and I can act upon that. I think that is unique to Silicon Valley. Even back to the original days of Atari, there was this idea that you could have an emotional, professional career, and that's okay. You can say, I want to do this because I want to do this, and that's accepted. Andy Hertzfeld. Woz might not say that he is driven by artistic values, but if you look at the work, that's what it is. All that crazy creativity in the Apple II was art. Steve was fundamentally motivated by artistic values. I had artistic values. The artist wants to spiritually elevate the planet. Ev Williams. Larry Page and Sergey Brin are driven to create. I saw this at Google. They are like this. Steve Jobs. The people who really create things that change this industry are both the thinker and the doer in one person. The doers are the major thinkers. Did Leonardo have a guy off to the side that was thinking 5 years out about the future? About what he would paint or the technology he would use to paint it? Of course not. Leonardo was the artist, but he also mixed all his own paints. He also was a fairly good chemist. He knew about pigments, knew about human anatomy, and combining all those skills together, the art and the science, the thinking and the doing, was what resulted in the exceptional result. Ev Williams. Tons of other businesses are driven by people who like to transact, to do business, or make money. I mean, you can be on Wall Street and just transact. What's different about Silicon Valley are those people who are driven by the creation. David Levitt. People make a huge difference, and in a crazy way the technology is just incidental. Alex Totik. In the rest of the world, technology didn't matter. 20 years later, we won. It's worldwide. There are internet cafes in Zambia. They have cell phones. They know Google. They know Apple. The Valley has utterly conquered the mind share. Mark Porat. If you say New York, people around the world generally know what it is. And now if you say Palo Alto, they kind of know what it is, too. That's kind of weird. It's a village. Alex Totik. Now, what happens here really affects things everywhere else. It's very different. Now we attract normal people. Before, we were like a tribe, and now everyone's in it.
Brenda Laurel. It's ironic. Silicon Valley has gone from a countercultural kind of thing that grew out of hippie ethics and the Whole Earth Catalog to a mainstream belief system shared by young entrepreneurs around the world.
John Battelle. Technology has gone from a countercultural kind of thing that grew out of the Whole Earth Review and the hippies and a sort of boomer dissatisfaction with the status quo into a mainstream belief system shared by young entrepreneurs all over the world. Steve Wozniak. And they are usually young people. Look at the people who started Apple. Look at the people who started Google and Facebook. Very young people just out of college. Jim Levy. I don't believe that the guys who founded Google at the time they founded it thought it was going to be what it is now. Certainly Zuckerberg didn't think Facebook was going to be what it is now. But over time, so many of those things happened that now you find the Valley to a great extent populated by people who expect that that's what they are in it to do, another Google, to do another Facebook. That's not taking anything away from Silicon Valley as the engine that it is now. It is what it is, right? Jeff Skoll. And it's interesting to think about where it will go. I don't think that the Valley has ever tried to use its political power in the way that it might. Certainly now it has the money. It certainly has a stranglehold on world dynamics in the way that it just didn't 10 or 15 years ago. John Battelle. I don't know how I feel about that, to be honest. Jeff Skoll. I get this image in my head of these very powerful, overgrown kids who don't quite know what they have, and the rest of the world is just sort of at their disposal. And so, what happens next? Book 1. Among the Computer Bums. The best way to predict the future is to invent it. Alan Kay. The Big Bang. Everything starts with Doug Engelbart. Doug Engelbart was the first to actually build a computer that might seem familiar to us today. He came to Silicon Valley after a stint in the Navy as a radar technician during World War II. The computer then, and in post-war America there was only one computer, was used to calculate artillery tables. Engelbart was, in his own estimation, a naive drifter. But something about the Valley inspired him to think big. Engelbart's idea was that computers of the future should be optimized for human needs, communication and collaboration. Computers, he reasoned, should have keyboards and screens instead of punch cards and printouts. They should augment rather than replace the human intellect. And so he pulled a team together and built a working prototype. The online system. Unlike earlier efforts, the NLS wasn't a military supercalculator. It was a general-purpose tool designed to help knowledge workers perform better and faster. And that was a controversial idea. Letting non-engineers interact directly with a computer was seen as harebrained, utopian, subversive even. And then people saw the demo. Doug Engelbart. In 1950, I got engaged. Getting married and living happily ever after just kind of shook me. I realized that I didn't have any more goals. I was 25. It was December 10th or 11th. I went home that night and started thinking, my God, this is ridiculous. I had a steady job. I was an electrical engineer working at what is now NASA. But other than having a steady job, and an interesting one, I didn't have any goals. Which shows what a backward country kid I was. Well, why don't I try maximizing how much good I can do for mankind? I have no idea where that came from. Pretty big thoughts. Stuart Brand. There is a sense about Doug that he is trying to express what humanity needs. Doug Engelbart. Well, then I thought I'm an engineer, and who needs more engineering? What are the things the world really needs? So then I started poking around, looking at the different kinds of crusades you could get on. Someplace along there, I just had this flash that, Hey, the complexity of a lot of the problems and the means for solving them are just getting to be too much. The time available for solving a lot of the problems is getting shorter and shorter, so the urgency goes up. The product of these two factors, complexity and urgency, had transcended what humans can cope with. It suddenly flashed that if you could do something to improve human capability to deal with that, then you'd really contribute something basic. That just resonated. Jane Metcalf. Everything starts with Doug Engelbart. Doug Engelbart. It unfolded rapidly. I had read about computers. I think it was just within an hour that I had the image of sitting at a big CRT screen with all kinds of symbols. New and different symbols, not restricted to our old ones. The computer could be manipulating, and you could be operating all kinds of things to drive the computer. The radar technician training let me realize that a computer could make anything happen on a display screen, and that the engineering was easy to do. That was the spring of 1951. I got accepted to graduate school at Berkeley because they were building a computer there. Steve Jobs. And in those days, again, it's hard to remember how primitive it was. There was no such thing as a computer with a graphics video display. It was literally a printer. It was a teletype printer with a keyboard on it, and so you would keyboard these commands in, and then you would wait for a while, and then the thing would go ta-da-da-da-da, and it would tell you something out. Bob Taylor. Computing was, in those days, believed to be for arithmetic. That's it. Beta processing, calculating payroll, calculating ballistic missile trajectories. Numbers. I wasn't interested in numbers, and neither was Doug. Doug Engelbart. I finally got my PhD and was teaching and applied to the Stanford Research Institute, thinking if there was any place I could explore this augmenting idea, it was there. Stanford was a small engineering school then. Hewlett-Packard was successful, but still small. By 1962, I'd written a description of what I wanted to do, and I began to get the money the next year. Bob Taylor. There was this proposal called Augmenting the Human Intellect by someone at SRI whom I'd never heard of. I loved the ideas in this proposal. The thing that I was most attracted to was the fact that he was going to use computers in a way that people had not, to, as he put it, augment human intellect. That's about as distinct a phrase as I can think of to describe it. I got in touch with this chap, and he came to see me in D.C., and we got him started on a NASA contract,
which was quite a bit larger funding than he had had previously.
It got him and his group off the ground. Doug Engelbart. I got the money to do a research project on trying to test the different kind of display selection devices, and that's when I came up with the idea of a mouse. Bill English. That happened in 63. We had a contract with NASA to evaluate different display pointing devices. So I collected different devices, a joystick, a light pen, and Doug had a sketch of this mouse in one of his sketchbooks. I thought that looked pretty good, so I took that and had the SRI machine shop build one for me. We included that in our evaluation experiments, and it was clearly the best pointing device. Bob Taylor. The mouse was created by NASA funding. Remember when NASA was advertising Tang as its big contribution to the civilized world? Well, there was a better example, but they didn't know about it. Doug Engelbart. We had to make our own computer display. You couldn't buy them. I think it cost us $90,000 in 1963 money. We just had to build it from scratch. The display driver was a hunk of electronics 3 feet by 4 feet. Steve Jobs. Doug had invented the mouse and the bitmap display. Jeff Rulofson. An SDS-940 was used for the demo. Butler Lampson. The SDS-940 was a computer system that we developed in a research project at Berkeley. And then we coaxed SDS into actually making it into a product. Engelbart built the NLS on the 940. Bob Taylor. Doug and his group were able to take off-the-shelf computer hardware and transform what you could do with it through software. Software is much more difficult for people to understand than hardware.
Hardware, you can pick it up and touch it and feel it and see what it looks like and so on.
Software is more mysterious. It's true that